Hey, it's Tristan. It's really nice to have you here. I'm a new guest host on the pod, so I thought I'd quickly introduce myself. I was previously the chief of staff at Comsor, a Series B community analytics company. These days, I do coaching and fractional work through my company Beyond Founders, where I help operators and leaders lead with more clarity and purpose. I'm part of the Chief of Staff Network community, and I'll be guest hosting a few episodes this year. I'm based between Berlin, Kuala Lumpur, and Singapore, and you'll find me bringing on chiefs of staff from across Asia and Europe onto the pod. I'm really excited to share today's conversation with you. My guest is Priyanka Piramsetti, Engineering Operations Director at Crunchyroll. Priyanka is a seasoned operator whose career has taken a few turns, from civil engineering to product solutioning to community to being a chief of staff and customer excellence. In this episode, we'll talk about how Priyanka thinks about integrity and why it matters in the chief of staff role. Also, how she spotted signals of high performer attrition super early and what a chief of staff can see by being in this role. She's also got a simple five-step way to figure out how the most strong-willed leaders can see eye to eye. That's something she's been working on for many years. And last but not least, we'll be talking about how a zigzagging career can actually be an advantage as you grow into the more complex operator career. Priyanka is thoughtful, practical, and extremely candid about the hard parts of this role. I think you can get a lot out of this one. I'm excited to be here. Let's get into it. Hi, Priyanka. How are you doing?
I'm really excited about this conversation. So yeah.
Super, super excited to have you on the podcast. I think we could just kind of dive right in. The question I want to start with is, what is some early context that will help me and us and everyone listening to understand who you are today? Who is Priyanka?
I can start what I am on a resume, and then I can also give you a sense of who I am as a person. I am the Engineering Operations Director at Crunchyroll right now. Crunchyroll is a major anime streaming services owned by Sony Group. I've studied engineering, civil engineering, and then I've done my post-graduation liberal studies. So this is someone who didn't want to build bridges for the rest of her life and then was really fascinated by how cool it is to, to solve problems from an interdisciplinary approach. I think I've done a bunch of roles in different stages of the companies and, in different functions. Like, I've done growth, partnerships, product solutioning, community, chief of staff twice, and customer excellence, before this. And mostly, figured out, things by doing and picking up, roles that involved me punching up on some level, because I don't have the traditional MBA to make me feel ready for these roles. Personally, I'm a multiple hobby enthusiast. I enjoy sport. I'm an elder daughter, grew up in a small town. So there is also this whole hunger, to prove yourself and resilience to all figure it out all by your own. So that pretty much gives you a sense of, say, who I am as a person.
How does, the resilience and wanting to prove it and make it, how does that show up in your career and life?
You end up being the person who would not give up easily. Of course, you'll cry through it. You'll question yourself. You'll question your ability. You'll figure out, newer ways, to solve a particular thing or attempt a particular thing. So I think the way it has manifested for me is, I think, to be a lot more courageous in my choices. There's almost a sense of, there's nothing to lose. What would I lose by trying this? What would I miss out on, say, by not attempting something, right? So I think this whole sense of wanting it all, I want to see where this goes or where this takes me. And that resonated with, all of the career choices that I've done and all, in fact, all of my personal choices as well. So I think you just refuse to give up.
So currently you're the Engineering Operations Director at Crunchyroll in India. What I'm hearing is hey, it was not a clear path and you're kind of changing departments often, changing job scopes often. How did you land here today at Crunchyroll?
This is the easiest to answer because it's retrospectively everything makes sense, right? While you're figuring it out, am I doing the right thing? But I'm glad I'm able to look at it with a much kinder lens now. I've been a B2B SaaS operator all of my life, fortunately also for product first and tech first companies. And like I mentioned, working in multiple roles in different functions in this context, I think predominantly prepared me, to look at cross-functional problem statements and pick that with the confidence that only generalists would have. The other part of it also is companies are willing to take a bet on generalists, because these are intersections. These will require nuance. These probably are not necessarily the area of expertise of, you know, say SMEs, subject matter experts. So they wanted someone who would, you know, walk in, understand the problem statements, look at the symptoms, be able to differentiate it with the pain points, and then come up with like the first draft of a solution again and again. I think retrospectively, it is that ability to context switch, look at a problem statement both from a 30,000 feet and also like with like a nanoscope of sorts, and be really be able to work with people and leverage, you know, like what individuals and teams and people, you know, bring to the workspaces and projects. I think largely, if I were to put like an analogy, it's like the maestro in like an orchestra. Like you probably are not playing the violin, but like you would know when to pull in who and whose space to, you know, to pick up at a particular moment. I think it would be that.
Yeah. So like being able to have the overview of like all the different players, but also knowing the skill, I guess, of everyone that's in the orchestra. You must be a good chief of staff if that's how you're seeing things and kind of able to have an overview of stuff.
I wouldn't say it's intuition, but I think it's just like the deliberate, immersive, you know, say ways of working, right? Like you just don't know someone by their titles or their job descriptions, but like you work with people in the root of, you know, say problem, you know, like wherein, like as you have a typical war room scenario, right? Like everything's breaking. You really need to, you know, get to like an answer. So you'll really try to observe different people's, you know, like their style of solutioning and usually arrive at like, you know, this level of, I think, intuition. Mostly by way of elimination, like you would have tried everything. So like you now know this is what works and this is what lands. So yeah.
How would you think about the type of operator you are today versus like 10 years ago?
I'm a lot more self-assured. I think I've now understood what operators like say meant when they said like, hey, I'm just winging it, right? Like there is no perfect answer. There's no perfect framework. And the nature of, you know, the problem changes every single day in certain circumstances. So like, I think I've become a lot more self-assured, be able to pause without running through the fires. And there's certain level of, I think, equanimity that also came through sitting through the fires. I think like when you started out your career, you would not be able to differentiate a fire, you know, that can be doused easily and a fire, or that probably, you know, could kill a particular function that you wouldn't know. Like all you know is that like you're burning. So,
yeah.
But now I think there is some sense of understanding that like, hey, this fire could wait. This fire, I could channel it. I could delegate, or let's say some other team, you know, can pick up this fire. And this fire, we've decided we will live with it. So like, let's just like design better suits, you know, for us to sit through this. So I think that sense of comfort has come in, I'd say.
I think this fire analogy is extremely relatable for myself. I know for a fact also many, many chiefs of staff, which fire to prioritize. You know, the classic saying is like a chief of staff is a firefighter that's kind of going out and, you know, managing all these different fires. After many years of being the firefighter, how do you think about which ones to prioritize and which ones to not prioritize?
I think you understand it from the stakeholders and the beneficiaries that you work closely with, right? Like some fighters are a function of a process that's loosely executed. But some fires, in fact, some fires don't look as hazardous either. Like, for example, there has been, like, say, a particular tech partnership, you know, that has been signed up. It's been working well for years. Now, you've never gotten to define, let's say, what well means, right? Like, there are no success metrics. Prima facie, it looks all good. But when you start digging in, you realize, you know, say there are problems, you know, that are much deep-rooted than, you know, like any of the metrics are showing you. So that becomes like an indicator into which fire will consume us, you know, say now, and which fire, you know, could just like kill us all in like, you know, like 3 or 4 years, right? So I think just the ability to dig in to stuff, I think like that's the only way I've figured out how you'd be able to differentiate, you know, which one is important and which one, you know, say is skippable. Two, I think also a sense of how metrics show a particular picture, but then like the minute you, you know, you try to, you know, say take a step and, you know, look at, you know, say if these, you know, say data points are telling the story that we want to know, or, you know, say are these data points, you know, say telling a different story that we are not ready to, you know, to ask ourselves, right? There are certain projects that work the way they are intended to. Everyone's happy. But as your business is changing, like none of us, you know, paused enough to look at, like, do we even need this anymore? Or do we need this in a different format? Do we need this to be automated? You know, what's the ROI of this, right? Like it's running well, but like, is this even something that will help us, you know, like leverage to a more, right? Like, so these are some of the things that you need to be very curious about, inquisitive, you know, like ask those questions. And I think a good hack would be like, just like ask why this and why now every like say 3-4 months. Like the 3-4 month window has come down to like a monthly affair. Things are changing that fast. But I think just revisit, you know, to your why and the importance of that now is a good way to understand what's a fire I need to care about and what's a fire, you know, like I'm willing to end it.
Do you have an example of a fire over the course of your career? An example of a fire that didn't seem that important, turned out to be really, really important.
So I think this is from one of the Chico staff stints that I had. There were, I think, high performer attrition that we started to observe. This is, you know, like when the company was going through a very interesting, you know, say transition. And as a chief of staff, because I did end up, you know, like owning all the special projects, all the 0-1, you know, like say mandates, worked very closely with the leadership and their minus ones. So there was a very interesting vantage point into who's invested in these projects, like who's understanding the why, who's moving at the pace, you know, say that these projects or these mandates required, and who was, you know, getting disengaged, right? Like who didn't share the urgency or, you know, who didn't share the why of, you know, say why we're doing these things. There were, I think, like a few conversations of, you know, retaining a few high performers. And I think on the surface level, it just felt like, hey, this is just like one or two people. They've been 10 years, you know, say it's just the right time for them to move on. But I think what I did as a fun activity is, you know, say if this person is thinking this, who else in the org could be thinking this, right? So like I made like a list of people who looked disengaged, who were known for a particular style of working earlier. And then like there was a visible, noticeable change in, you know, how they brought themselves to work. Like literally almost like a attrition prediction list of sorts, right? So I made a list of that and then like, you know, shared with my principal. And we had those conversations in that exact order. Like it was freaky to believe, you know, like these people were thinking. But I think the way I feel it was rightly understood is because, you know, like you are probably, as a chief of staff, you're probably the only person who's sitting through the meetings at the senior leadership level and their minus ones and their minus ones as well. So like you probably are the only person, you know, like who would have that vantage point into how a particular org OKR is defined, how leaders own it, and how, you know, say delivery teams execute it, and what are the roadblocks that each of these levels, you know, like will face. So I think that was an interesting example of, you know, how a chief of staff also will have to be the person to preempt situations like this, and probably no one else is thinking about these problems. So like, hey, will we still have the high performers that we once had for us, you know, to take us through the next phase of this company's growth? And it's not even a problem statement to think of it, right? Like, but like the fact that you are able to, you know, just look at these signals and then sense something feels off here. Let me just like, you know, go and double tap on that.
How important then is the relationship you have to your principal in being able to do that exactly?
High trust environment, like the fact that you could be delegated to, you know, to pick on these cues and not be perceived intrusive. I think it is a non-negotiable. Like, I think what I recommend is, I think like the first 30 days, I think like of you being a chief of staff, your principal really have to echo this sentiment with his or her leadership, you know, saying, hey, this person is a proxy, you know, to how I think and how I execute. And if this person's asking for something, assume I'm asking for this, right? Like, so it is a non-negotiable, like people will have to really perceive you and then like engage with you as a proxy to the principals. Second really is, I think you also got to understand that you are not someone who's not a class monitor, who's just like asking for performance reviews of, you know, say different leaders, right? But in fact, you are someone who they can trust to, you know, to work with them. You're trying to, you know, say move things together. You're being the catalyst, you know, say for things that they probably don't have the time and bandwidth, you know, to pull in together. That would be second. Like they need to understand that you are with them and you're not against them. The third thing would be really to not carry a particular bias. You need to have like a surgical level of, I think, a neutrality when you look at the organization, right? Like this looks good, but this is a great performer, this is an okay leader, but then like what does this really matter, right? Like how are they translating into actions? How are they translating into outcomes? The whole dissonance between efforts versus, you know, it's the end game, right? Like what does this mean in the day-to-day? And then like what are some of the risks that we can foresee from right from here? I'd say these three things would be the top.
As your career has progressed, and as you've maybe prioritized the wrong fires sometimes and over-prioritized the wrong fires and, you know, didn't have that instinct, how has your understanding of the role, I guess, and the importance of the relationship with your principal change over time?
You would fail a lot more than you'd succeed. So like, it's a given, right? Like, there are more things that you probably would have initiated, would have, you know, like failed. There are a lot of things that you think, like, you're almost like tuning your brain to, you know, how your principal thinks and works, because the first 30, 60, 90 days is really trying to embody, you know, let's say their spirit of sorts, right? Like, it's their brain acting through a different person. It really is like that. Like, you start to, you know, like, think like them, you start to write like them. So that is a journey that you'll anyway go through. But I think in that process, you would also find yourself conflicting between like, hey, what would I do in this scenario versus what would my principal do? I think the biggest internal struggle would be that. And it's a catch-22, right? Like, a chief of staff is someone who's expected to be extremely opinionated, has a very strong point of view of their own, versus, you know, say they're also expected to, you know, to think on behalf of someone. So there is going to be a clash of the styles of working sometimes. So I think like that took me the longest time to be able to differentiate that and then don both of those hats in different scenarios. It's not like I'm losing one of them for the other. The second attribute I think I would say is to really not punch myself on scenarios where I have been wrong, because it is the entire orgs context. There's a history of, you know, say movements and developments that I'll have to internalize when I walk into a role. So it will take time. So I think like one has to be patient and not question the intent with which, you know, you're getting into these conclusions. You will get there. It's just going to take some time. And it's going to take a ridiculous amount of, I think, context filling in by your leadership and your principal. Like, without them validating what you're thinking and you're like, how you're processing this, could take years. So it is very important, you know, like, that you have, like, as simple as like a no agenda conversation every day. You know, like, this is how I'm looking at it. Is this the right way to look at it? This is my impression of yourself, this leader. Is this the right lens? So I think like this constant back and forth and the validation of sorts, those really do help.
Yeah. You know, I've spoken to many chiefs of staff, and also when I was the chief of staff, I noticed that the quality of the relationship, the amount of trust between my principal and me and any chief of staff and their principal, how much you are championed in the company and how much you are championed by your principal or the executive team can really change your experience as a chief of staff. Because when you don't need to, let's say, fight for your right to be there, especially if you're kind of coming in from the outside of the org and suddenly you have full access to everything, which can be very disorienting for the team, right? Suddenly there's this new hire that's coming in and they, on paper, have more authority than I do. But I've been here for like 10 years, you know, and they're younger than me, most likely.
It is an interesting perception to fight, for sure. Like you said, like usually probably the youngest in the team probably has the access to every possible document that you can think of in the organization. You're looking at comp data, you're looking at, you know, say, projections. So like, this is sensitive information. Now, the caveat and the baseline for this is your integrity and accountability needs to be perfect, like near perfect. I think this is one of those roles wherein you cannot afford any scope of error. Your integrity has to be unquestionable. A lot of trust also comes from that fact, right? Like, people are talking through their situations a lot more than you would expect. So like, without that discretion, I think like all of this is a failed endeavor. But I think to your point also on how people don't feel threatened by the fact that, you know, hey, there's this person who's asking all these questions, you know, like they need to know everything. I think he is to understand that like, this access will help me to, you know, to put in the pieces together. It's not to evaluate someone's performance. It's not to, you know, say, not to micromanage, not to be nosy without intent. That's not the idea. But I think it is to really coherently understand the big picture. And as a function of that, like, to make their own lives easier. So I think that has to be the lens to look at it. And this needs reiteration. Like, you have to reiterate this. Your leadership will have to, you know, like, emphasize this. Your principal will have to repeat this. You'll have to train that muscle.
I like that you say the word integrity. That's a really, really strong and powerful word and really, really relevant for this role. What would it look like to do this role without integrity? Like, what is doing this badly versus doing it well?
You will be out of this, I think, in a week, for sure. Let me take a step back and then define what I mean by integrity here. Right? Like, one, imagine a pyramid, right? Like, the base is, you know, say you cannot gossip, you know, like you need to keep, you know, like sensitive information for yourself. You need to be accountable for your tasks. You know, like, say no one's going to follow up with you. So you own your tasks, you own your principal's tasks, you own the leadership tasks and their leadership's, you know, tasks. So that is baseline. Now, a level above that is, I think, just have the discretion to see and share what's needed when and to who. Because you have the big picture, not everything needs to be known by everyone, and for a good reason, right? Like sometimes information also passes through people before it's thought through, before it's presented in a palatable way for people, you know, to consume and then like to act on. So knowing when, to who and what, I think is the second level of integrity. And the third level is really this, right? Like, are you putting yourself and the team and the org above everyone else? And this involves, you know, taking difficult decisions. Like you're probably saying no to a lot more things than yes, which means that, you know, you do not have a vested interest. You are not carrying any active bias, and you're keeping the teams and the companies, you know, say intents above everything else, I'd say would be like the top level of that pyramid, right? So in this sphere, I think if you don't have integrity, at level one, you'd be like a very bad project manager. Like imagine someone else is following up the chief of staff and the things that they're supposed to close, right? Like it's the most funny thing ever. Level two, you will, you know, like say, you will add more chaos because you have context. So you're, with your way of, you know, say adding context to people, you're just going to confuse more people than, you know, create clarity. So it's just more chaos. You're adding noise. You're adding active noise, you know, to, you know, context and information. And on the third level, you probably are not doing anything meaningful. You know, like if you're not asking the right questions, if you're not being the voice of reason, this role doesn't really add any value. You know, like you could imagine, you know, say principals and teams without this role and things would be exactly the same. So
thanks for sharing that. I like the pyramid. Did you just think about this now? Or is that something?
I did. I don't know why the whole Maslow's hierarchy has just like come to hand. I'm like, let me try to, you know, figure out if there is like a panel. I value integrity as a value. Even as someone like who's outside of work, right? Like I really think that makes you dependable. I think even when I started this chief of staff role for the first time, right? Like I think I realized people are not expecting you to be a subject matter expert, but people need to feel that they can rely on you. I think integrity is at the core of this trait, right? Like, and it only has helped me because people have trusted me to say that, like, hey, I'm actually failing in this project. Can you help me out? And you need those honest, you know, like, say, conversations, you know, to be able to fix things. So I think personally also do, you know, like, value integrity a lot.
Interesting. By having integrity, you know, as a chief staff, you make yourself more trustworthy. So, you know, it's easier to hold sensitive information, and there's more trust around holding that information because you conduct yourself with integrity in, you know, how you show up every single day. I totally agree. I think that it's completely crucial because, as you said, like, if you don't do the things you say you're going to do, then what's actually the point of your role? You know, like, obviously that's true for like every role in the company, but I think especially the chief of staff.
Yeah.
Once you have access to everything and you have all these ideas of how things can be better, but you don't do anything about it, then it's the same as if you were not there, those things would just exist anyway, you know?
It's like a human version of an Excel sheet that nobody asked for. This also, interestingly, makes you a very, very less threatening devil's advocate in these rooms, you know, because people are trusting you. So even when you're asking these difficult questions, people don't feel threatened, which is the most important thing, you know, like when you're working, right? Like you don't want people to be defensive when you're asking these difficult questions. So I think like the fact that, you know, hey, if you're known to be as someone, you know, with integrity, like even when you ask these difficult questions, people will not take it personally. They'll understand that she's asking, you know, this because it means something. And it just helps you ease through, you know, like a lot of, you know, like office drama that you don't want.
Yeah, I love that so much. I guess just like any role, right? Like any role in the company, you have the potential to lead through the way you show up. And I think with the chief of staff, because you're under so much scrutiny, because, you know, you're championed by the founder, for the executive team, there can be a lot of expectation of like, who is this person? And like an inquisition is like, you know, can they be trusted? Who are they? Why did they hire them? Are they going to take my job? And I guess conducting yourself with integrity, you know, it helps you slot in into like this foundation, you know, of the company, as opposed to being the chaos maker, which might be perceived, right, when you bring in a chief of staff. Like, is this a consultant? Like, why are we hiring a consultant to come in? You know?
I know, right? Like me, like, why is this person saying the obvious?
Yeah. Why are we paying this person to do this?
Like, not that the chief of staff, you know, like, don't ask themselves this question, but like, it is what it is. Right? Like, this role can feel pretty existential if not being done right. So, makes the two of them.
Since we're talking about the role, we have so many different ways to define what a chief of staff is. And that's like one of the things that we find it so difficult to land on. I'd be curious, based on your career and your understanding and your experience, how do you define what a chief of staff is?
So there is the whole, imagine the whole universe, right? Like there is...
Existential, very existential.
It is like, imagine your own Avengers of sorts, right? Like, so there is the chief of staff, there is the founder's office associates, there is the entrepreneur in this sense, there is the executive assistant. Now, different companies, like say, pick and choose different attributes of these roles, you know, to make their own custom, you know, say chief of staff, ninja of sorts. But if you were to ask me, strictly a chief of staff who's expected to be a strategic and an operational advisor to a principal, he's just an extended arm to the CXO. This person and this extended arm with a muscle memory of, you know, say how things are done. You would take the first shot at, you know, say the first version of, you know, say what a solution could look like for every problem. You are the one, you know, who's asking the difficult questions. You're looking at if the interlocks are working as expected. You're the person who's looking at, you know, what makes this business redundant in 3-4 years? What should we be doing about it? You're the person who's looking at keeping your eyes and ears very close to your customers, your competitors. You manage the investor relations. So like you really are the extended arm to your CXOs. And a chief of staff could be to the CEO, to the COO, CFO, any CXO, right? Like, and if you are a chief of staff to the CEO, then like you're universe is, you know, like that much, you know, like you're looking at every possible function. But if you're like a chief of staff to a particular function, then you dig deep into, you know, say every process, every silo, every team pod within that function, and then like, you know, try to make it easy. Now, the why of it is two ways, right? Like, I think we've also seen, I think like just like companies just like slap a chief of staff role without intentionality. And then like, and they really don't succeed because companies and principals often are not clear on why they're bringing one in the first place. There has to be a certain level of, I think, readiness to understand that, like, this is exactly why we're bringing one. And by bringing one, this is what we expect to build change in our ways of working. Like, you can't bring the chief of staff and then say, hey, let things be running as usual, right? Like, you're doing a disservice to everyone. I think certain level of, I think, readiness needs to be understood from the people who are bringing in a chief of staff. And the chief of staff really, you know, like, will embody how the company, you know, like, and the processes and teams work as is, and what can it be? Now, depending on, you know, say, how drastic, you know, the needs are required, you do it, you know, slowly, or, you know, it's a peacetime or a wartime scenario. So the chief of staff becomes the bridge between, you know, say, what the company has been versus, you know, what it can be on some level.
Well, I really like the bridge because, yeah, I think you're right. Like, there's this element of bridging the current state and then bridging to the future state. And that can also be applied to, you know, you work with your principal and they have a specific vision of what they're seeing. And that's the vision they're presenting to the board, you know, and you're on those meetings. And then it's like, okay, great. We have this vision. We got to do it. And then the chief of staff, you know, I guess this is another clear torch bearer for this next chapter of whatever the company is experiencing. And so, so the bridge, right? The bridge between the CXO and the rest of the company in some senses, because the chief of staff role can traverse functions in a way. It's like the messenger that kind of goes around, you know?
And it does happen, right? Like there will be days where on a particular quarter, you know, you'll have to figure out, you know, everything that's broken between sales and marketing. Move to the next quarter, you know, you can get, you know, say, product and engineering interlock. So like you are this traveling, you know, say, nomad of sorts, like jumping from one function to another function because different functions require interventions in different time points, right? Like, so you will be that person who's, you know, like fluid enough, you know, to move from one P0 to another P0. But I think the idea also is that, you know, you're translating the ops context to everyone, you know, who's working. Really, like you are being the translator of, you know, say your org OKRs. You know, like say there are, you know, these 5 or 6, you know, OKRs that you've promised to the investors. What does it mean in the day to day? What does, you know, having X, you know, say a jump of, you know, say 20% jump in my NPS mean to the customer success associate, you know, who's sitting 5 levels below the CXO, right? Like, so I think you really become that translator of why we're doing and how we do that.
I know that you have another framework and the framework is around working with principals. So I think in the earlier conversation that we've had before this call, you mentioned having like the kind of a playbook for aligning strong, opinionated leaders who don't see eye to eye, which I think is very relevant for people listening on this podcast. Could you walk us through at the high level? What is this framework? How did you develop it? And please help everyone, help the leaders see eye to eye.
I'm going to tell how important this is because I've been asked this question in every single interview. So this role, not just for a chief of staff, I think like as you grow, as you move into, you know, like mid-senior roles as well, like I think this is the baseline of, you know, say how you work every single day, like how do you work with, you know, say strong opinionated leaders, right? Like, so this, me and my principal, you know, like we figured out, you know, like we were working with a few leaders and we came up with this together. So a 5 or a 6 step, like this is how it worked for me, right? One, imagine, you know, like say you and, you know, say the head of, you know, finance, you know, like have a decision to take and both of you don't see eye to eye. So we're going to have like a 3-day conversation. Step one is, you know, I'm going to take permission from the both of you saying, hey, I'm going to take the role of a facilitator. Do I have your permission to steer this conversation? Then comes, you know, say, I'm going to ask the both of you, what are your top two non-negotiables of this conversation? Like there could be a million things be done about it, but what are the top two things that you need a decision on for this project without which you are not willing to leave this firm? So what that does is it defines the boundaries of, you know, say what we're going to play into. Otherwise it could just trickle into, you know what, 5 years ago we did this, it still didn't work out. Like you got a time out, you got to fence this. And all through a small hack, like while this conversation is happening, I usually, you know, have my Notion, you know, screen up. I'm sharing my screen. I'm typing things as they're talking. So people also know what they're committing to. It just makes it visual. People are a lot more intentional about when I say what they're saying. So it just becomes a very immersive exercise if you're not doing it in person. Then comes, you know, say, I'm going to ask who the decision maker for this problem statement is. And it's usually, it's easy, right? Like whoever is the primary beneficiary of this particular project can be the decision maker. But like what this also does is, you know, say one person will have to back down or, you know, find a midway. So you're telling, you know, like who is the person who is responsible for this decision. So it just makes it that much easier. Then you come to the basics, right? Like now you feel the conflict. What's the problem? You know, like what about it is, you know, say the burden here, the what, why, how, and who, right? Like you cover the trade-offs, you understand the implications, you understand the historical, you know, say baggage of, you know, say why this didn't work. The fears, or say, what would happen if, you know, we were to do this? You now, like, say, you feel the entire thing, right? And the last step really is, now that we've understood all of this, now that we know the top two non-negotiables, what is a minimum loved solution that, you know, say, that both of us are willing to, you know, say, move ahead because we can't keep running in circles? What are the top two next steps that we do? Who are the people who will bring this decision through execution to life? What are the timelines? And then you're done with the call. I think what this has done historically is, one, you fence the conversation to a problem and not a person. So it doesn't get personal. People don't feel defensive to justify their point of view. Two, you're understanding what's important for both the stakeholders. And I can't emphasize on this enough, right? Like you're hiring these leaders to be opinionated because they are very good at what they do. So you need to understand why they are, you know, say, emphasizing for certain things. Instead of, you know, say, just like brushing like everything with like a, you know, like a white paint, you need to understand why a particular leader wants a particular thing to be done a particular way. So this, I think, has helped me, one, get into a solution seeker, but also I'm an empathetic facilitator. I understand why you need this. So what's the best way, you know, that we could all agree to so that we all move ahead. I'm not making this up. I actually have these 5 steps drafted. I keep going back to this because I think you would work with leaders with conflicting opinions probably every single day. You need to figure out a way that works for you. And this has been working for.
Okay, so we have step one is make sure that you get permission to kind of take on this role as a facilitator, which really is kind of like, as I understand it, asking for consent to be in this role. Step two, we have what are the non-negotiables that are on the table and document this so everybody knows the minimum that people want out of this, or rather why they're not willing to make any concessions. Step three, we have agree on who the decision maker is. So that's also something we agree on as opposed to this kind of going on and on. We have step four, peel the conflict back to the basics. So this is digging into it. So understanding the how, the why, the what, the who. And something you said was like, hey, you have the Notion page screen shared so that all this is written so that we have the same understanding of the source of truth. And then after that, we understand the trade-offs and implications from peeling things back. And then we can decide, you know, what are the next steps.
This took time. This took multiple, I think, deep like this, you know, where I went to say, okay, is this comprehensive enough? I'm pretty sure, I think, as I put myself into more complex scenarios, the playbook might evolve. But this has been a skeleton version that has been working so far.
I really, really love that this is something that took time and it's crafted from like real experience, which I guess maybe step two was different or step four was different. Or maybe there wasn't a step two or four. And then you've kind of added those in. What is it like to do step one, which is to get consent that you will be playing this role?
It is literally that, right? Like, hey, I'm going to say, can I, you know, like have the permission? Do I have your consent, you know, to be the facilitator, which means that I'm going to be asking a few discovery questions. I'm going to be playing your devil's advocate. I'm going to be asking for data points. I'm going to be asking for your why of, you know, say why the solution is, you know, is what you prescribed. So I'm going to be the person who's going to do all of this. So do I have the permission? What that also does is, you know, sometimes you also can't be self-absorbed as a chief of staff, right? Like that also brings out saying, hey, probably I will need one more person. You know, like there needs to be another person who is needed for this conversation. So that also enables, you know, like for you to, one, not pull 20 people in a team, you know, like say to arrive at a decision, but you're only pulling in the people who are extremely needed, who have the full context, and then, you know, move to the decision faster. So I think that process of, I think, taking consent just, I think, takes away any ego, any conflict, any sort of like a threatening sensing, you know, who's this person, you know, like walking in and asking me these questions. So that takes away all of that out of the room. So now it's just like three people who are just curious, you know, to solve the problem. It makes it extremely objective.
And who in your experience, like, so context is like, I'm thinking of situations I've definitely been in. I'm wondering who normally is, yeah, in the situations you've been in, like, are you the one to initiate even step one, or is your principal the one's like, hey, let's bring Priyanka in?
It's both of them. So usually you would have a sense of, you know, hey, this particular project is not moving the way it's supposed to be. So you would summon a meeting. You could ask, you know, say, hey, this is what I've, and this is what have been my observations. You probably given a preview saying, these have been my observations. This is what, you know, say is alarming. We need, you know, say 1, 2, 3 decisions, you know, to be taken so that the teams feel more clear and aligned. So you could be the one who's initiating. It could also be, you know, say the principal knows that, you know, hey, this is a problem that we've not been able to fix. I need a third person. I need a neutral facilitator to host this because there could be the blind spots on the principal as well. So then you would be called upon, you know, hey, can you, you know, say facilitate this conversation because we really need an objective, you know, say next step from here on. So it could be either of those. Like your own curiosity will lead you there, or your principal's, you know, say summoning also could lead you there.
And how have those conversations gone when you've played them out and the many different times that it's gone?
I think this playbook largely has been successful. Probably people would hate you during these conversations because you're just asking the most difficult questions, right? Like, for example, an outcome of a conversation like this is usually, you know, you're going to pull the plug on a project that didn't serve anyone. Now, this is not an easy conversation, right? So I think during this process, it might feel like, I don't like this. I don't like where this is going. But I think all of these conversations have been well processed and understood, I think, in a quarter's time. People then understand, yeah, like this, that was the right decision to take. That was an important, you know, say, alignment to happen. So usually you will not see immediate effects of this, the unfortunateness of this. But I think this will really, to the point of, I think this will prepare you to a version of future that you want the company to be in. Fortunately, I think like most of the conversations I've had like this, I think like have been understood a quarter from then on. But I think as a chief of staff, you need to hold your ground and have the patience to wait that out.
Some of the themes and words that have kind of come up as we've had this conversation today have been like right now, facilitator. So, you know, chief of staff potentially being a facilitator of conflict. I think another one we had was around...
like a bridge.
Maybe the bridge. Yes, yeah, that's the one. So being a bridge, you know, being the facilitator, in the context of the bridge, we talked about bridging where we are now versus where we want to go. Facilitator, it's in a way, it's the same, right? It's like where we are now, which is we're not seeing eye to eye, and where we want to go, which is clarity on what the situation is. My thought is that great chiefs of staff, which it sounds like you are a great one, understand this dimension well. They understand and embody this dimension and take on with enthusiasm, I guess, like this side of being a chief of staff. I think there's like the executing side, which is you're competent, you have high integrity, you're very skillful in performing, like doing the task. And then there's this other part, which is you're able to interpret the different contexts which you are in and understand which fires to prioritize. And I think great chiefs of staff understand which fires to prioritize because they integrate what they're seeing and learning from the different contexts. And the better you can do that, then the better you can serve the principal, you know, the company, you coming up with this framework of the different five steps. And the fact that this has been evolving over time, it tells me that you have been growing on this side of it, like understand how to actually be better at absorbing context and applying that to how I show up every single day.
I really like the way you've put it, because early on, I've also realized, and this is most journalists would also relate to this, right? Like, because you're not a subject matter expert, you really have to play to your own strength, right? Like, I've learned early on that, like, you don't necessarily have to become the average of being decent at everything, but then really leverage what you're really good at and then like be really good at just that. That is a differentiator, right? Like for me, I've always been someone, you know, who's understood, you know, say the way people operate. I've always been curious about what people's motivations are, right? Like I see people as people and not job descriptions or titles at office. So what that does is, what's in it for this team, you know, to collaborate, right? Like what would they need? And what's the blocker, you know, like for this particular thing to happen? Is that a person problem? Is that a budget problem? Is it a buying problem? So I think I've realized if you are someone, you know, who's very good at a particular style of, you know, solving problems, a chief of staff really helps you flourish in that, because it's all you. It's a personality hire. No two chief of staffs are similar. So like you really get to, you know, like play your own version of who you want to be at a workspace. This role really, really gives you a stage for that. I can't think of any other role which allows you to be this flexible, this fluid, and this absorbing. You know, like you literally can go and say, hey, I want to pick that project. The project is yours, right? Like, so it is really giving that way.
Yeah, lots of agency, right? Like you have agency, but with great power comes a lot of responsibility.
Because the integrity piece. Yeah, it is true.
I've really, really enjoyed today's conversation, Priyanka. Would it be all right if we ended with some rapid fire questions?
Oh, no, let's go.
All right. So tell me about a belief about careers that has completely changed or has been evolved, you know, as you've gone through your career.
Being a career zigzagger is fine. In fact, that's recommended. I think growing up, I've seen a lot of people who've spent decades or, you know, more in just a single job or an industry or a particular role and was understood to be safe, stable. But I think retrospectively, the fact that I was able to change multiple roles, I've not done the same role twice in the same industry. The only exception has been a chief of staff. I think that really served me, because like you understood how businesses work, agnostic to the industry and agnostic, you know, to the stage of the company. So I think being a career zigzagger is okay. And I fully believe in that now. In fact, I recommend that to people, because that's the only way you'll be able to be prepared, you know, safe for how dynamic, you know, careers can look like.
Yeah, I really like that. What is one thing you wish hiring managers and or recruiters better understood about a generalist?
Don't ask them for attribution of work. And I'll tell you why. I think like most recruiters are used to, you know, say individual contributors or, you know, say managers who have a quantifiable metric that they own. Chief of staff and generalists are catalysts. Not all of your work translates into a metric. While we try to make it, the attribution is a little fluid, right? So like, I think don't reject, you know, say generalists based on the metrics that they're owning. A good generalist and a good chief of staff probably is, you know, say working behind the scenes. So like get into the ways of working, ask them for a portfolio of, you know, say how they solved a particular problem. Don't ask them, you know, say for what's the metric that you want, but like, how did you solve for this? What were, you know, say the risks that you've taken? So I think like be a little more open about the qualitative aspects of, you know, say what their resume looks like. I think recruiters are not as forgiving as you'd like them to be.
Last one for you is, how has being a chief of staff impacted you as a person?
It made me, as a person, really, I think it made me sit with chaos a lot more better. I think it helped me be a lot more composed. It gives me a ridiculous sense of prioritization. Like if there are 20 things that are happening, I'm like, I'm going to tackle these three today. The rest can wait. And two, I think a great sense of, I think, self-assuredness in the way I look at the world, the way I look at life. It makes me feel invincible on some days. It makes me feel, what am I even doing with my life? I think like, but it really helped me be a lot more comfortable in my own shoes or heels, so to say. This role really gives you everything that it has. Like it's the boot camp that nobody asked for. It's a nightmare while you go through it, but it really does reward you at the end.
And bonus question is, when things are tough, you know, I mean, I think the cycles of being a chief of staff, the ups and downs can be so drastic. when it's been difficult for you, what has helped you kind of come out of the ruts you've been in?
One is give it time. A lot of these things change with the function of time. Two, it's not the end of the world. And I can't emphasize this enough, because I think when I was a chief of staff, I had trouble switching off. Like 24/7, you are a chief of staff. Like, I was not able to minimize that tab that's running in my head all the time. But I think it takes time, you know, like say, eases a lot of things. And then this role will take time to be understood as a successful, because trust takes time, impact takes time. Chaos, you know, say, needs time, you know, to be understood. Recommendations, you know, take time more to be seen with the same level of urgency. So like, it's just a very patient game. So I think if I were, you know, to tell myself in like one message is, you know, like, hey, you know, you're doing this well, just be patient. Don't beat yourself up for this.
On that note, Priyanka, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you so much.